listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov is spending most of the week in the Persian Gulf area. On Monday, his travels took him to Qatar, where he met with that country's foreign minister, Mohammed bin Abdul Rahman bin Jassim Al Thani. The two held a press conference following a working meeting in Doha on Monday morning.
Ladies and gentlemen, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, thank you for the talks we had today. Mr. Lavrov's visit to Doha is the next step in developing our bilateral relations based on the understanding between the leaders of our countries. Today, we covered all the different areas of bilateral relations, including the economy, sports, military cooperation, defense contracts. In recent times, relations between Qatar and the Russian Federation have been improving. We are grateful to Russia for playing a role in resolving certain issues. We appreciate Russia's position and the message that Russia sends to various players in the Middle East. Also, during our meeting, we discussed issues of mutual interest, primarily Syria. We talked about the situation on the political track and developments in northern Syria, the situation on the ground. It is Qatar's position that political solution, political settlement is the only possible solution, and that it should take into account the interests of the people of Syria. We also discussed Libya. We discussed the need to restore security in this country. We need to unite the government, unite the military, strengthen the government system of Libya. We also exchanged our views on the Palestinian issue, on the peace process, and our joint efforts to overcome the rift between different factions among Palestinians. We stress the need to overcome this division. We appreciate Russia's efforts in this matter. When Russia hosted the meeting of various Palestinian factions, we appreciate what Russia does for Palestinian factions to engage in talks with Israel as a unified platform, and we are also interested in developing our bilateral ties. Ladies and gentlemen, first of all, I would like to thank our hosts for their warm welcome, for their hospitality. Today, we had detailed talks with the deputy chairman of the government, the foreign minister of Qatar, and earlier this morning, I met with the emir and gave the greetings from the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, to him. During the talks, we reaffirmed that we are all interested in maintaining political dialogue, which is of mutually beneficial to extend Russia-Qatari cooperation in various areas. We agree with our Qatari friends that we need to further develop trade economic ties between our two countries. We welcome efforts taken by our bilateral trade commission, which will meet the next time in Moscow on April 10th. Also, simultaneously, we'll have the 4th Arabia Expo and the meeting of the Russian Arab Business Council. We believe that the Russian Direct Investment Fund and the Qatari Sovereign Fund are working together well, and the stake of the Qatari Fund in Rosneft. We also pointed out that there are other oil companies, Lukoil, Zarubezhneft, Gazprom, Novatek. All these companies are also interested in considering joint projects with our Qatari friends. We will coordinate our efforts on the international energy market. This includes gas-exporting countries forum in Doha. After this event, I will visit the headquarters of this organization. I will meet with Yuri Sinturin, Secretary General of this organization. We also mentioned that our countries have been working together in sports. After Russia's success with the World Cup in Moscow, the next World Cup will take place in Qatar in 2022. And we pointed out that the organizing committees of the two countries are in close contact. We are ready to share our experience and share our recommendations with our Qatari friends, share the solutions that worked during the World Cup in Russia. On international issues, we paid special attention to the situation in the Middle East, of course, the Middle East and Northern Africa, primarily Syria, Libya, Somalia. We believe that we need to stabilize the situation in these countries as soon as possible, based on international law, through an inclusive, all-encompassing peace process, which should be closed, though, for extremists, regardless of whatever slogans they use. We also talked about the Palestinian conflict. We believe this conflict should be settled based on international law, and we believe that Palestinian unity should be restored as an important condition for engaging Israel in direct talks. We also discussed the situation in the Persian Gulf. Russia is genuinely interested in normalizing the situation, and I mean all the different aspects. This includes the ideas that Russia has been promoting in recent years as part of its concept of collective security in the Persian Gulf, which is a strategic region of the world. Once again, I would like to thank our Qatari friends for their warm welcome. And now I ask my colleague to pay a visit to the Russian Federation whenever that would be convenient for him. A question from Al Jazeera for Minister Lavrov. Vladimir Putin has invited Benjamin Netanyahu and encouraged him to normalize the situation in the Palestinian territories. Several days ago, we saw reports that the Russian president may go to the region, especially to Qatar. And I also have a question for the Qatari minister. Has there been any progress at the talks to normalize the situation in the Gulf? And did you talk about this to Minister Lavrov? As regards the visit by Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu to Russia, of course, we discussed the situation with the Palestinian-Israeli settlement during this visit, and we reaffirmed our position that Russia is interested in overcoming the current stalemate in this settlement, and we reaffirmed that the Russian Federation is ready to host a meeting between Israeli and Palestinian leaders, Benjamin Netanyahu and Mahmoud Abbas, so that the two can resume direct dialogue without any preconditions. This is what Israel asked us about, including Benjamin Netanyahu himself. And Mahmoud Abbas also agreed with that. So the offer is still on the table. We believe this would be an important step towards rebuilding trust, at least. And without trust, it would be impossible to expect further progress in the Palestinian-Israeli settlement. Please repeat once again, because I had Arabic in my earpiece. Question about President Putin's visit. Russia's ambassador to Qatar said that the Russian president may visit the region, including Qatar. Do you know anything about the dates? Well, I thought this was a question addressed not to me. The emir of Qatar has invited the Russian president to visit the state. He accepted the invitation, just like invitations from some other countries. Well, it's up to the protocol services of the leaders of these countries to determine when such a visit might take place. Now, as for your question on us making progress in dealing with the crisis in the Gulf and whether I raised this issue in talking to Minister Lavrov, we haven't seen any progress as yet. Sabah, the Kuwaiti emir, hasn't been able to make much progress. Still, we are ready for a dialogue, and the U.S. is taking certain efforts to stop this confrontation in the Gulf. Yet, there hasn't been any progress, and we don't see any signs of improvement in dealing with this conflict with our neighbors. The position of Qatar has been clear from the very start. We are ready for dialogue. And we will be ready as soon as the countries that impose this blockade on us are ready, yet they refuse to talk to us. We shared our vision of the current situation with Russia. We believe that this has negative effects for our entire region. And we hope that together we'll be able to improve the situation in the Gulf and in the Middle East in general. Mr. Lavrov, in your talks with Qatar, did you talk about creating a working group to normalize the situation in Syria? When do you think such a group can start working, given regular provocations by Tahrir al-Sham, which still control a large part of the area north of Latakia and Hama provinces? And my first question for the Qatari minister, has there been any progress on reinstating Syria in the League of Arab States? Well, the answer is very brief and simple. We did not discuss this issue, and I don't think we need to set up some working groups for Syria. We have the Astana process, where the government and the armed opposition, with the mediation of Russia, Turkey, and Iran, are engaged in a dialogue, and this dialogue has been quite successful. We see tangible results. And we also have representatives of the UN, Jordan, and formerly the United States involved as observers in this process. Later, the United States dropped out of the meetings in Astana. And we may have some more observers later on. We also have the special envoy of the UN Secretary General for the Syrian settlement. And there are countries in the region that want this crisis to be resolved as soon as possible. We are in contact with all our partners in the region. We are not limited to the Astana format. We work with all the key countries in this region, all the countries that can have and which can contribute to resolving this crisis. We also contact with the so-called small group, including Western countries. We worked with Turkey, France, Germany. We had a summit in Istanbul of these four countries, Russia, Turkey, Germany, and France. And we also have a channel we used to discuss the situation in Syria with the United States for the military and for our foreign affairs services. So we do have a network of contacts which eventually should bring about results. I don't think it makes much sense to set up an additional artificial working group. But formally, we still have the International Syria Support Group, which was set up by Russia and the United States together with the UN. We haven't had plenary meetings of this group for a long time. But then there are two subgroups created by the International Syria Support Group. There is a group for ceasefire and a group for humanitarian issues in Syria. So these two subgroups regularly meet two or three times a month. They meet in Geneva, and there are representatives of over 20 countries in those groups. These include some regional players, Western countries, Russia, China, Iran, and others. So I don't think there is a shortage of mechanisms. It's just important that all the countries follow Resolution 2254, just like we do in the Astana format. We want the people of Syria to resolve all the issues themselves, and nobody should stand in the way, like when our Western partners did late last year when they insisted on postponing the formation of the Constitutional Committee. We are not hysterical about it. We'll complete our work in the Astana format, and we hope that the UN colleagues will soon realize the need to bring about this mechanism as soon as possible. Thank you. You asked about reinstating Syria in the League of Arab States. Our position remains the same. We think that we haven't seen anything happening on the ground that would make us change our position. And we certainly want to have a government in Syria which serves the interests of all the people and protect the people of Syria.
Two questions for the both ministers. Last year it was reported that Qatar was buying S-400 defense missile systems from Russia. This caused some problems with Saudi Arabia. I just wanted to ask what the status of that deal is. Have they been delivered? When will it be delivered, if not? And do you expect more military deals between the two countries? Secondly, ongoing in Doha at this very moment, there are talks with the Taliban. Previously, Russia hosted talks with the opposition. I just wondered if both countries believe there will be a favorable outcome with regards to these talks, which you're both involved in. Thank you very much.
Regarding the arms sales of that Qatar has with Russia or with any other country, we believe whether it's Saudi or...
As regards agreements between Russia and Qatar or Saudi Arabia, we believe that this is a sovereign decision to be made by each of the countries. We didn't talk about this. We only talked about the technical issues of our cooperation with Russia. We don't have any particular vision regarding S-400 systems. We have technical teams, specialists, talking about various options. What would be best for all the parties? We have channels we use for this kind of cooperation. And as far as we know, these groups, these teams, will submit their proposals based on the needs of Qatar. Next, you asked about the talks between the U.S. and the Taliban in Qatar. These talks continue.
We are going to continue coordination.
As regards our contacts with Russia on this issue, we have special envoys and special channels of communication, so we keep talking to Russia. We want all the forces that want to see peace prevail in Afghanistan, all should work on this. And we believe that the Afghan problem can only be resolved peacefully. And we hope that these talks, as my colleague has said, regarding our defense contracts, it is regulated bilaterally. 6 months ago, we signed an agreement on defense cooperation. We'll proceed based on this document. So whenever there are requests by our Qatari friends for defense contracts with Russia, we will consider those requests. And as regards Afghanistan, we do follow, we do monitor the talks between the United States and the Taliban. Representatives of the Taliban have visited Moscow as well, since sometimes we host events to mobilize the international community, especially countries neighboring Afghanistan, helping them to launch a political process. So in the past, when we just started this work, our U.S. partners even accused us of violating a U.N. Security Council resolution, even though everybody knows that the United States itself was talking to the Taliban. Now it's all over, and the Washington Special Envoy for Afghanistan, Mr. Khalilzad, regularly meets with my deputy. They have a good contact, and I think this is very useful. Instead of being rivals and having this kind of artificial competition, we should work together, because the United States, Russia as a neighbor of Afghanistan, other neighboring countries, we can all help the people of Afghanistan to launch this national dialogue, which alone can resolve and stop this conflict. Igor Zhdanov, Russia Today. I have a question for Mr. Lavrov about a different region. I would like to ask you about Venezuela. John Bolton, U.S. Presidential National Security Advisor, says that the U.S. follows the Monroe Doctrine. Do you think it is even legitimate to refer to this 19th century doctrine? Well, after the UN was set up in 1945. International law has been regulated by the UN Charter. This is the universal and most legitimate organization. And this backyard theory and practice is openly offensive. So I believe that responding to such an arrogant statement by John Bolton, this is up to Latin American countries whether the Monroe Doctrine can be applied to Venezuela. Actually, he insulted all of Latin America, especially since a few days ago we heard an official threat coming from that Washington saying that Cuba and Nicaragua are next, that Venezuela is not the end of it. So it's up to the countries of Latin America to consider this policy. And I know John Bolton well. I'm familiar with his statements. Just recently he tweeted that Maduro lied about Russia providing medical aid to Venezuela. I don't know where he gets his facts, but some time ago we did provide Venezuela with a shipment of medical aid through the World Health Organization and the Pan American Health Organization, this was 7.5 tons of medical supplies. So it's not a lie. John Bolton probably heard this from somebody else. Probably he was misinformed, and he immediately circulated it worldwide. So I would stick with facts. And we are concerned by U.S. intentions in Venezuela. I openly told Mike Pompeo about it when he called me a couple of days ago, expressing his concern about the Venezuela government threatening Mr. Guaido. And I told him the United States threatens all the people in Venezuela, asking the military to forget about its oath and inciting a rebellion. So if anybody should refrain from threats, it is the United States that should do it first and foremost. Thank you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
And welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Failure in Hanoi. What are the lessons to be learned? Also, stalemate in Venezuela. And a Brexit update. And much, much more on this edition of Crosstalk. Cross-talking some real news, I'm joined by my guest here in Moscow, Glenn Deason. He is a professor at the Higher School of Economics, as well as author of The Decay of Western Civilization and the Resurgence of Russia. And in London, we cross to Alexander Mercuris. He is a writer on legal affairs, as well as editor-in-chief of TheDuran.com. All right, gentlemen, cross-talk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Let me go to London first. Alex, let's reflect upon the failed summit in Hanoi. What is the most important lesson to be learned if anyone wants to learn any lessons? Go ahead.
Well, for me, the United States needs to revise its approach to negotiation, because what the United States does, and we have to go beyond Donald Trump in these situations, is they don't really negotiate at all. They make demands, often maximalist demands, and they expect the other side to capitulate to them. And what happened in Hanoi was that Donald Trump came along. He made the usual demands the United States always makes for complete denuclearization and for steps towards denuclearization. And he said to Kim Jong-un, I'm not prepared to do anything in return. I'm not prepared to lift or moderate the sanctions in any way. And, of course, John Bolton apparently then joined in, and he made even more demands.
Apparently. Glenn, you know, one of the things I found very interesting is, and Trump's public approach right before the summit in Hanoi, is he was talking about and trying to convince the North Korean leader what kind of future his country can have prosperity. The potential is enormous. I mean, his superlative language as usual. But what was interesting is that the Koreans, North Koreans, are first and foremost interested in security guarantees. And then we can talk about what can happen after that. A complete misconnection between the two leaders.
And I think maybe that's why Vietnam was chosen as a venue as well, because
he demonstration effects.
Yeah, demonstrating this is a communist country, former adversary of the United States. It's not allied with China, and now they're becoming more and more prosperous. They got great relations with the U.S. Essentially, this could be you if you just fall in line, get rid of your nuclear weapons, and maybe we won't bomb you. And I guess that's, yeah, maybe. And I think
you're going to bet the farm on a maybe here. Well, that's of course what the North Koreans are thinking about.
But I wouldn't necessarily say that it was a failure. I mean, it was in terms of getting the grand deal they were hoping for. Yeah, definitely they didn't get it. But this, I feel, was always an overreach. However, at the end of it, they didn't dig back in their trenches and begin threatening each other. Instead, they kept, speaking kind words. They didn't necessarily blame each other in,
At least it was a dignified exit.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, the North Koreans said they're not going to test nuclear weapons or long-range missiles, and the Americans won't do any military exercises on their borders. Now, how long this lasts is another thing, but it hasn't failed yet, I guess.
And okay, that's a good point. I like your optimism. Let me go back to London. Alexander, the good news about all of this here that is the mainstream media fails to report, and the Pentagon and the State Department are probably behind closed doors irked about, is that the two Koreas are actually working together. This is the real story here, okay? The real story is, can the United States let go and let the Koreans sort out their own affairs? Because they're making progress. Go ahead, in London.
That's exactly right. Now, can I just quickly make one very quick point, which is, of course, yes, Vietnam is now a friend of the United States after there was a conflict which the United States lost in a way that secured Vietnam's security guarantees. Now, with Korea, it's rather similar. There are two Koreas. The two Koreas are now negotiating with each other. They have concerns about, each of them has concerns about security. South Korea does not want a nuclear war on Korean territory. It also has an aspiration to move forward with its relations with the North, because that's very important for South Korea economically also. And the risk the United States takes by sticking to these maximalist positions and not moving from them is that the Koreans will start to negotiate with each other and will cut out the United States.
Okay, that's a good way to end this part, this topic here. Let's move on to Venezuela. I'm calling this program Deadlock. So we went from Hanoi. Now let's go visit Venezuela. The coup attempt apparently has stalled. The photo ops and all the media coverage of the humanitarian aid over the bridge failed here. And then we have the random guy chosen by the United States, basically in exile. Where does this coup go from here? Because the U.S. still has a lot of tools in its toolkit.
Yeah, no, I guess it boils down to what Trump will do, because there's still a lot of uncertainty about what kind of a president he will be on foreign policy. Again, when he ran for president, it was very clear he wouldn't have any more foreign wars. Now it's a bit uncertain whether or not, after Syria, Iran, whether or not this is something he will really follow through. I think initially it could have seemed like low-hanging fruit in terms of like a non-violent coup, something that, minimal effort and essentially change the government completely. But now that they have to use military force...
Can I use the term, it's going to be a walk in the park? A cakewalk. This sounds like, the planning for Iraq 2003 here. No, there's a complete misunderstanding of what's going on in Venezuela.
Yeah, and I guess his base is looking at him as well, because if he does decide to use military force against Venezuela, then essentially he's done the same as Obama, Bush, and everyone before him. So it is an interesting time to look at his presidency, because so far he's only used kind of the threat of war in order to extract concessions. But now he's kind of at a crossroad. Either he pushes the U.S. military in or he starts backing off. So it's Yeah, I would be very careful to look at my, you know, crystal ball on this one.
Oh, I think everyone should. Let's go back to London. I was going to weigh in on that because it looks like the planning for this, they thought it was going to be easy. They thought it would be the facade of the government would collapse once they've chosen their favorite one. And now it's not come about. And now we have Venezuela looking to move a lot of its export oil operations to Moscow out of Lisbon. I mean, the Maduro government has resources, and of course, the most important thing is the military remains loyal, and this is something Washington miscalculated. I warn you about Abrams. He's a troublemaker. He'll make you false promises. Go ahead, Alexander.
Well, I think their miscalculation was even greater because I think what they've done has actually strengthened the Venezuelan government. I think it was actually quite unpopular because of the situation with the economy. But it's quite clear that most Venezuelans do not want to see their president picked for them by the United States. Very few of them had heard of this Guaido individual, who none of them had elected. And I think what has happened, and it's entirely unsurprising, is that the people of Venezuela and the military of Venezuela have rallied to the defense of their country as they see it. And I think the great danger here is that now that the political prestige of the United States is invested in engineering the fall of the Venezuelan government at a time, as I said, when Venezuelan opinion is rallying behind that government and when international opinion has very far from moved against that government. Venezuela has friends, that the United States will now double down. And you mentioned the name of Elliot Abrams, and of course he has history of orchestrating wars against Latin American countries, and there's already talk of blockades and of tightening up sanctions and of imposing secondary sanctions against other countries. And of course, the danger is that this conflict could escalate and grow and draw neighboring countries in.
That's a very good point, you know, because Glenn, as we speak right now, Colombia and Brazil seem to be getting cold feet. They, again, I like your phrase, the low-hanging fruit. It looked like it was going to be a done deal. Well, it's not a done deal. And if there were to be a military operation against Brazil, and I agree with your logic, Trump probably doesn't want to go there because of his reelection prospects here. But Colombia doesn't want to be pulled in, as Alexander Mikiris just said. I mean, this could be a regional conflict that nobody really needs and nobody wants. But what are the U.S.'s options right now? Just continued intensive economic warfare against the population of Venezuela?
Yeah, and I think the U.S. is running out of options because obviously they could continue economic sanctions, make life more difficult in Venezuela, hoping that it would over time bring down the government. But see, Alexander quite correctly pointed out, a lot of it's backfiring because I think a legitimate argument can be made that Maduro has done some mismanagement of the government since Chavez stepped down or passed away. But of course, now that Guaido's on the record saying that he might call for the United States to invade his country.
His own country.
Yeah, so obviously that's not going to sit well with Venezuelans. So that was already a polarized country, but that's not going to win him much support from the other side. And again, I've noticed that Trump, he hasn't rhetorically invested too much into intervention just yet, just saying that all cards are on the table. And this aggressive rhetoric is cheap, but he hasn't actually essentially put any red lines, such as Obama did, something that can be used against him. So he left him enough room to maneuver to pull back. And
let me finish off this segment with Alexander Mikiris. The rhetorics are very interesting here. This rhetorical battle against socialism and using Venezuela as an example is actually part of his domestic re-election bid here. 20 seconds, Alex. Go ahead.
Yes, I mean, that's exactly the point, because, of course, he's pointing to the economic crisis in Venezuela, and he's talking about how people like, his opponents in the United States, his left-wing Democratic opponents in the United States, define themselves as socialists, and he says, well, we don't want in the United States what's happened in Venezuela. So it plays to him politically in domestic terms.
Okay.
It's
a very interesting dovetailing here. All right, gentlemen. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT.
listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, now we're joined by John Laughlin. He's in France. He's a lecturer in political philosophy at ICES, the Catholic University of Vendée. John, welcome to the program. Glad to have you on. My least favorite topic these days is Brexit. I'm tired of thinking about it. I used to think long thought that there was just a democracy deficit. Now I'm convinced there's the worst problem is a leadership deficit here. Can you do your best to try to sum up what's happening now with Brexit? This is like a 2-year nightmare that never ends. Go ahead, John, in France.
Well, if you're bored, Peter, you're not alone. There are 60 million British citizens who feel the same way as you do. And many, no doubt, hundreds of millions of observers from all around the world. I completely agree with your question. And what strikes me about this ridiculous, drawn-out nightmare is that it embodies one of the systemic problems of today's politics, and that is the inability to change anything, the inability to effect any kind of genuine alternative, to choose an alternative. We see this, of course, with Brexit. The agony over Brexit, over Mrs. May's deal, is all the more absurd because her deal is not a deal. Her deal is agreement to leave everything as it always has been for the last 40 years. And the same goes for populism in Europe and for Donald Trump. What we see is in all these three cases, people announcing radical change, promising radical change, and then sticking with the policies that have existed for decades. Trump's colonization, the colonization of Trump's foreign policy by the neocons is a perfect example of this. Yeah. Trump promised us the opposite of a neocon foreign policy, and we have, of course, now you can't move in the Oval Office for neocons at the moment. And the same goes for the European populists, who make a lot of noise and claim they're going to put an end to immigration and so on. I'm thinking particularly of Matteo Salvini, but actually stick with the same policies, and particularly, of course, with their commitment not only to the European Union but also to the Atlantic Alliance.
Okay. Let me jump in here. You know, Glenn, John brings up a fascinating point. I mean, it seems that the double whammy here is that you have an inflexible neoliberal philosophical outlook, and then you have a structural problem where there is no it isn't fluid enough for any kind of change. So you have this structural problem and this ideological problem reinforcing the worst parts of both.
And I think what John mentioned is very much what summarizes or what defines the populist. I mean, it seems like they ask the right questions. This is what brings them into power. That is questions which has been suppressed for too long. However, they don't really have any answers. And I think this is problematic. So the questions they would ask is, to what extent is this neoliberal economy going to work? I mean, the salary has been stagnating for 2 decades. To what extent can we mass immigration until the social fabric begins to tear away? Has NATO expansionism made us any safer? Have these endless wars made us any safer? So they ask all the right questions, which essentially no one has been allowed to ask yet. But once they ride the wave into office on these elections, they effectively don't have any great answers, and they don't necessarily do much to change. And
let me go back to John in France. I mean, then I ask a very serious question. I'm not trying to be flippant or anything, but I mean, then what is democracy for? If people are given choices, they vote for choices, something different, and nothing comes about. I mean, it's all through the continent. And Brexit is probably the most glaring example, but there are many other examples that demonstrate the same phenomenon. Go ahead, John, in France.
Well, we don't live in democracy in Europe. It's very straightforward. I've spent 20 or 30 years explaining that the European Union is an undemocratic organization and showing why, and showing with constitutional arguments why that's the case. But we can see it in the pronouncements of politicians. Theresa May is the absolute epitome of a European politician who regards the Brexit vote as an absolute catastrophe. She regards her role in this whole thing as clearing up a mess created by voters. And that view is held across the entire continent, and certainly, of course, in the institutions of Brussels. David Cameron, the Prime Minister who organized the referendum, is regarded as someone who created a terrible situation for no good reason at all. In other words, these people are viscerally opposed to democratic choice precisely because of what I just said, which is they do not want things to change. They do not want there to be a choice. They do not want people to say yes or no to something. They want people to follow the lines which have been set down and which are institutionalized, particularly in things like the European Union. And I don't think that populists lack the answers. That's not my diagnosis. What I think is that populists, and indeed politicians of all colors, lack is courage.
Yes.
We know that many things in the European Union that various individual governments don't like. Viktor Orban doesn't like the immigration thing. He's fighting on that. But on the Russia issue, we also know Matteo Salvini's party, the League, has a formal partnership with United Russia. They are formal allies of the governing party in Russia. But they have not changed. They have not managed to abandon, for example, the sanctions against Russia, even though those are prolonged every 6 months as a result of a unanimous vote. See, we see this extraordinary phenomenon of groupthink, or at least of inertia, which means that actually very little ever changes in politics.
It's crystal clear what John is saying here is that from an elite perspective, it's the people that have failed, not the leadership of these countries and not the leadership of the EU, because they're infallible. It's almost like a papal bull. We cannot be wrong. Only you can be wrong. Glenn.
Yeah, it's in Norway, we actually had our prime minister making that argument that because we rejected EU twice, so she said it's putting it up to referendum would be a mistake because the people that vote quite emotionally, while
emotionally. Oh, isn't that nice?
While the wise politicians, they would know really what's best for us.
So, wise people.
So and again, it's not that different from Britain, as John pointed out. It's the political class never wanted this. Again, for David Cameron, this referendum was a way of restoring harmony among the Tories and taking some air out of the UKIP balloon. And they didn't expect the referendum to go through, but now that it's gone through, they're essentially offering two options, either the Remainers Brexit, so Brexit only in name, or we can stay in the EU. So because no deal would be madness,
false choice, because they had 2 years to try to figure something out here. Let me go back to John in France here. I mean, John, how much longer can these elites hold the population's voters in contempt?
Well, the situation we're describing is very similar to the one that was caricatured by Bertolt Brecht in 1953.
I'm trying to think of the quote as well. Go ahead.
Yeah, exactly, where he said, well, they'll have to dissolve the people and elect another. You know, the government continues, but the people has to change. The answer, it's not possible to answer your question, Peter, when is it, how long is it going to carry on? We thought, or I thought, or some of us thought, things might change in 2016. But people were predicting the downfall of the Soviet system for many decades before it happened. And, you know, it's very difficult to know exactly when it will happen in the case of the European Union, which, of course, as I've said many times on your channel, bears a number of resemblances to the Soviet Union.
Yes.
So it's not possible to say. All that we can say is that there are increasing tensions, and there is no good news for the European Union. Everything is bad news. So there's north-south conflict between Germany and the southern European countries over the euro crisis and their debt. There's east-west conflict on liberal values versus traditional values, particularly with Poland and Hungary. There's obviously the major crisis with Brexit, which means that the European Union is losing the world's financial capital, its second biggest contributor, and one of its biggest member states. There is no good news to temper this series of bad news events, which has been going on now for well over a decade. And so at some point it will collapse. But when? I pass on that question.
You know, I'll go back to Glenn here. You know, one of the interesting things is when you look at these populist movements across Europe, they're very dissimilar in many ways. But the way I look at and populism is a dirty word, apparently, in the mainstream here. But what these populist movements are doing is pushing up against the system in an ideology that doesn't work. And of course, every single country will have its own specific elements there. But this populism is deemed bad because they're demanding change. That or a status quo that isn't working for them. I mean, I think even on a rhetorical level, this is they try to pollute any kind of activism in people wanting to regain sovereignty in every sense of the word.
Yeah, and I think the best thing, if the establishment really wanted to get rid of the populists, the best thing they could do is to engage with their arguments. Because,
yes.
Again, there's a reason why these people have come to power, is because they're asked the questions which have been denied. Now, So you can ask this in terms of what does it mean to be European, as John pointed out. Is it about ethnocultural history? What should be the ideal economic politics? Like,
tradition, a sense of community? I mean, this experiment wants to destroy nation states. They want to destroy all any sense of community. I mean, everybody is basically either married to or a ward of the state.
But effectively, they're trying to only suppress the populist movement again, because they're not engaging with the arguments, like be it Brexit or the Poles, the Hungarians. They're very different colors, but
yes.
Nonetheless, they're all portrayed either as being, you know, racist, xenophobe, or they're simply Kremlin puppets. So this is the way, essentially, of shaming opposition.
All right, let me ask John a real quick question. We got 30 seconds. Brexit, when is there going to be another vote? Okay, 20 seconds. I hate to torture you on this topic. Go ahead, John.
I believe there'll be a series of votes on the 12th of March, 12th, 13th, and 14th of March. And my feeling this morning is that there will probably be a deal. In other words, that Mrs. May's deal in a slightly amended form will go through and Britain will leave the European Union at the end of March or very soon afterwards. But then the battle will really start.
All right, John, I'm going to have to leave it off at there. But we'll be in touch with you on this topic here. Many thanks to my guests here in Moscow, London, and in France. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, Community Public Radio. .org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.